Herzlich willkommen bei Aufnahmebereit, dem Podcast für Ankommende und Aufnehmende in der modernen Migrationsgesellschaft. Sie hören diese Episode nicht nur auf den Podcast-Playern Ihrer Wahl, sondern auch auf Radio Orange 94,0.
Diese Folge wird Ihnen präsentiert von Courage, Mut zur Menschlichkeit.
My name is Judith Kohlenberger. I'm a migration researcher at the VU Vienna. And in today's episode, I'm talking to Milda Schilinskaite. Milda is a senior scientist and director at the Competence Center for Sustainability, Transformation and Responsibility, in short, STAR, at VU. And there she focuses on sustainable development and the SDGs in business and society. Her research and also her teaching span migration, cross-cultural management, and responsible global leadership. And she also has a strong emphasis on how narratives shape public understanding and policy. She engages widely with practitioners and international audiences, and this is what we would like to do in today's podcast. And for this reason, we're having this conversation in English today. So welcome, Milda. It's great to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, and a great introduction. Thank you.
Gave it my best. So the reason why I wanted to have you on the podcast today is because we had what I think was a very successful and highly inspiring public event in November last year called VU Matters, VU Talks, which is a whole event series. And this specific event that you moderated, but that you also gave a keynote at, was called Myth-Busting Migration. Very great title. And so my first question to you is, what is your favorite migration myth to bust and why?
Wow, it's a great question. But first of all, thank you for being a panelist on that event. I do think it was
really enjoyed it.
Great discussion. We could have gone on for a long time. There are four really great speakers there. Every single myth that we mentioned is important, right? And the idea of busting myths about migration, of course, it's not mine. It stems from decades of years of research in sociology, anthropology, political science. And I think in early 2010s, the daughter of Noam Chomsky, I'm forgetting her name, last name Chomsky, wrote a book on busting myths about migration in the United States. And then now more recently, 2023 or 2024, is Hinda Haas, whom we both know really well, a sociologist whose work on migration has been cited, you know, across fields. He's also written a book about migration myths. It's a different title, but basically it's about all the misunderstandings that the broader public has and that unfortunately policymakers often have. And even more unfortunately, even some scholars hold because of his general misunderstanding. So at least 10 or 15 big topics that, in my opinion, all require attention. Maybe the first one, because it's the biggest one and the one that I always start with and I care most about, is simply that there's no such thing as mass, you know, influx of migrants, and that migration is not some mass wave that is on the rise. And the fact that, yes, the absolute numbers have been increasing over the last five decades, but people forget globally that also the global population has been growing very fast. I mean, when we were growing up in probably middle school, what, we were 4 billion globally, right? And today, I don't want to lie, it's 7.8, 8.1. So it is obvious that then, you know, when the absolute numbers of migration rise, so does the global population. And the reality of relative numbers of the percentage of migrants worldwide has not really increased. And that's, for me, a very important point to make, because obviously we live in a time where the political discourse is all about migration increasing massively. It's just not the case. You can go country by country, region by region, and then obviously you see fluctuations and increases in some regions and decreases in others for many different reasons, and depending on the type of migration, but the global numbers are just, you know, not that massive and not that dramatic. And I think we need to kind of counter this drama effect that the media and the politics are now promoting too much. Yeah. So that's probably my first and most important myth that I think the general public should be aware of.
And that's a great one, I think. Yeah, and a very persistent one. You mentioned correctly that when we look at the numbers alone, both the absolute numbers, but also relatively to overall world's population, I think we're still around, is it 3.6% or something like that, or maximum 4% of the world's population can be considered migrants. What a definition is that you not only move for a few weeks to a foreign country to stay there as a tourist or a student, but rather permanently. Usually the most statistics say it's 6 months or more, and then you have a permanent change of country. So your residence changes. That would be the definition of a migrant. And this is actually, compared to overall world population, a very small percentage.
Exactly. It means that 97% of people eventually stay in their home countries, despite potential, you know, wandering off for a season or for a tourist trip, etc. So yes, I think it's 3.6, 3.7, but we also have to be careful with how it's measured. There's a great Oxford podcast on migration that, you know, reveals that these numbers are really hard to get. Obviously, they're approximates, even at the UN level, because different countries run censuses at very different times. And so some of the numbers that we have, you know, are from a decade ago because a certain country only did a stats that decade ago, et cetera, et cetera. But roughly the last 50, 60 years, we're at this 3.6, 3.7%, and that has not changed much. And I think except for the World War II, when the mass displacement because of the war was much greater, was around 8%, which for you as a scholar who works on forced migration is extremely important, because today's numbers are nowhere near 8%. I think it's 0.4 globally of refugees in comparison to the general migration. So,
yeah. Which is another very common myth, right? So the balance or the difference between what percentage of people who actually do move regularly, voluntarily, who can be considered in most cases moving for work, for business, for studying, etc., and what percentage moves involuntarily, is forced to move, can be considered refugees, forced migrants, etc. And the first group is, of course, much, much, much bigger and more relevant, we could say, in absolute numbers than the second group. But a lot of the, I would say, political discourse, the media debate focuses on the second group. Yeah,
exactly.
Refugees and forced migrants.
That's a typical scapegoating situation in politics, absolutely. And I think, you know, that also relates directly to this myth, the different types of migration. So, you know, you usually when you read a newspaper, and my big issue is also that often when you read a business and management article, this is one thing that my co-author Aida Hayro, you also know her very well, we work very close together, we mostly publish things together. Her and I are trying to kind of counter also this generalization, putting all the different types of migrants under one umbrella. Because so often an article in our field would start with the phrase, there are 310 million migrants in the world. Wait a minute, are you counting the 8 million international students in there? Are you not? Are you counting the high-skilled migrants and expatriates sent by their companies? Are you not? Are you, et cetera, et cetera. There are at least 10 different categories that you can use. And it's extremely important to look at them. Are you counting people who are affected by climate mobilities, right? There's another fear of mass migration induced by climate that also does not hold statistically yet. So differentiating the different types, at least in scientific literature, I think it's a start. And hopefully then the public will also start realizing that we're not talking about one thing.
Okay. Why do you think these myths are so persistent? Because the one you started with, right, we do actually not live in an age of mass migration, at least when we look at the numbers as such. There is no indicator that would suggest that a growing and an increasing, a really big amount of the world population is constantly on the move. This is not the case when we look at the numbers, when we look at all available statistics. Still, I feel this is a very persistent myth, a very popular myth that both policymakers, politicians, but also the media, and I would say also serious media outlets, you know, system media, some would call them, so those who can be considered not tabloid, but really focusing on fact-based reporting. Even there, you find this explicitly or implicitly, you find this myth that we live in this age of a mass migration and that this will be one of the biggest challenges of also the future, you know, how to manage and how to navigate these big migration movements on the horizon, those that are already happening, but also on the horizon. And I feel like on the one hand, you already gave one argument, I would say, of why this is happening. This has to go to do probably with scapegoating and with some kind of fear-mongering, perhaps also. We live in an age of polycrisis. And the moment you define something as a crisis, very often there are certain policies suddenly possible and feasible that would not be possible in a normal situation, you know, when people don't feel frightened or when certain exceptional measures do not have to be taken. So I think that's one dimension to it. But are there also others, you would say, other reasons why such myths have been so persistent despite all the work that has been done? You mentioned these two books that are quite, I would say, famous and popular, widely read, because they do not address an academic audience. They address a wide audience of interested readers. But still, it's really, really hard, I would say, to counter these myths sustainably.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a question that needs, you know, 2 hours more of discussion.
That's why
I'm
asking.
Let me see how to simplify. You know, I think there are two parts to a question like that. One is the actual historical reality, and myths and same as stereotypes are often rooted in some kind of real facts or you know, but then they're blown out of a proportion. So the reality is that if you look at specific regions, there has been a shift, right? And there has been an increase in migration in certain countries, especially here in Europe, that used to be migrant-sending countries. I mean, if we're talking about the age of migration, that was really the age of European colonialism. Let's start there. But somehow we don't look at the Americas or Australia or New Zealand, you know, as historically in the same way that we today look from inside of Europe being afraid of this mass migration. I mean, we did that. We basically
so
did that for two centuries.
Migration, you
it was
say.
Out migration, but it was also, you know, transporting slaves. So it was all kinds of, you know, forced and voluntary and all kinds of migration for all kinds of reasons. And for me, that was the true age of mass migration, was the era of European colonialism. Now, today, you know, 200 years later, whether you count or not neocolonialism, that's a whole different story. What we see in Europe, North America, Japan, South Korea, Australia is aging populations and this demographic change. I think, you know, we do talk about it, but not enough. But that's one of the main triggers of migration. Obviously, we need workforce. There are some numbers, I think, in De Haas's book of, you know, calculating the ratio of working population versus retiring population in the next 10, 20 years. How do we maintain the ratio? It is very obvious that the current population in most high-income societies will not suffice unless we do some kind of pension reforms and technology and migration combined. So there's this real drive. And Europe, for example, for the first time in history, is becoming migration magnet versus just a sending continent. So there is this reality regionally, right? But that doesn't reflect the overall global reality. And I think that's the confusion and the reasons for why migration is actually needed in Europe. Those are also downplayed too often in the discourse. The reality is we simply cannot do without it. We also saw what happened with the attempts in France to extend the retirement age, or here in Austria. Good luck with that. So, you know, we need to face the fact of demographic aging of the population, of women's emancipation, also having less children, right? And of many, many other factors. The general transition factors, economic transition factors of countries that used to provide labor force. So in Europe, for example, Eastern Europe used to be the region, as you well know, you know, that kind of provided Western Europe with a cheap, so to say, labor force. No longer the case at all. Most Eastern European countries lack now workers to work in jobs that are undesirable or lower paid jobs. And they're also importing workers from further, so from Central Asia or Southeast Asia, et cetera, et cetera. And which is called replacement migration, is phenomena that was observed in 1884. So it's very well studied phenomena. But basically all these realities, economic, demographic realities, add to the fact that migration is needed or some kind of reconfiguration, right? But it doesn't mean that globally there is a rise. It's reshifting of patterns in different regions. I don't know if I'm being clear or too detailed, or you tell me.
No, definitely. Yeah. I think you mentioned a lot of very important points here. Also the fact that myths or perceptions of migration, first of all, vary regionally, of course, and depending very much on whether the country you grew up, the context you grew up in, was a sending or a receiving country to start with, or whether you've lived through this transitional period of, let's look at Poland, for instance, or the Czech Republic, changing quite rapidly, actually, over a short period of time from a sending into a receiving country, or perhaps not even being able to navigate this transition in a, I would say, sound and feasible manner. I mean, Hungary is a good example where, of course, the overall doctrine is, let's close our country off, Hungary first, we don't need any foreigners. Whereas actually, they are having huge guest worker agreements now with Indonesia and other countries because they realize that they do need the workforce, despite this anti-migration, anti-foreigner rhetoric, which is super paradoxical, of course, when you look at it. But still, that's sort of the economic reality, which I think will hit many European countries rather hard in the years and decades to come if we continue this very, very restrictive direction that most European member states have now shifted towards, I feel.
Yeah, like Hungary is an incredible example. You know, we're based at the business school. We both may be outsiders of a business school because of our own backgrounds in PhDs. You're being sociology. I come from the area of humanities, but we are based at the business school. So the role of businesses, actually, in your specific case of Hungary, it's enormous. It is mostly multinational companies, enterprises from either Western Europe or the United States that originally had expanded to Eastern Europe because of a cheaper labor force, all related to the EU expansion, of course, right? Also looking for that cheaper production. And they literally built factories and established supply chains in countries like Poland, Czech Republic, Poland, my home country is Lithuania, right? Only to realize that as companies, they contributed to these shifts in a way, because the local populations with increase of wages and with the increased mobility and access to education, right, stopped wanting these jobs. And so now what you see, it is the big companies lobbying behind the closed doors in countries like Hungary. And Hungary is very welcome of actually guest, you know, they don't call it guest workers anymore, I guess seasonal workers or temporary workers in factories, because they know that certain companies, you know, are responsible for 10% of employment in the country. My home country, I was born in Lithuania, as I mentioned, literally went through emigrant sending country during my childhood to emigrant receiving country officially in 2018. Right. So net sending versus net receiving country. And you see that all over Eastern Europe. And the important thing is you also see that in Southeast Asia, in countries such as Thailand, Malaysia, right? Philippines are on the edge. These are countries with much larger populations, so it's taking time, but those are also shifting. So transitions are happening around the world. I think the next country to also observe, a very interesting one, is Mexico, because obviously on the case in the U.S., but the tariff wars have pushed a lot of companies to nearshore to Mexico instead of China because they have much better conditions on tariffs. And we see in just that 1 year already flows in migration changing. Yeah, it's really incredible to observe, but somehow slips through the news usually, right? It's not mentioned that businesses are key drivers of migration. So that's my other, you know, it's not really a myth, but I think it's overlooked fact. And Aida and I always try to push for this new narrative of the role of business. Because even in migration scholarship, most of the theories, you'll know you're sociologists, are about why people move, why the individuals want to move. Well, we say mostly it's actually businesses that create the demand. And we know that the demand for jobs is what gives the big pull, right? So I don't know if I'm diverging here, but this is, you know, the relationship to where we planted here at the Vienna University of Economics and Business.
And I mean, we know that also from so-called irregular migration, meaning forced migration, that many irregular migrants, so those who arrive without a residence permit to start with, let's say in Europe, are answering to labor demand. Yeah?
Absolutely.
And this is something we see, especially in countries like Spain, Portugal, Italy, and so on. Their agricultures would crash without the labor force provided by irregular migrants, people who do not very often hold a residence title. And that's to the advantage of the big business owners, unfortunately, because they exploit this situation, keeps the wages low, right? It's black work, yeah, basically. So the people are not registered anywhere. They don't pay taxes. The businesses don't pay taxes. So it's not an ideal situation for the nation state, I would say, and for the national economy. But of course, we, all of us, the European population, benefits from this because it keeps our fruit and vegetables, the prices of those produce, really low, right? So, I mean, I think we also always have to look at the economic dimension of this and what it means. And on the other hand, of course, very much intertwined with political, on the one hand, discourses, but also changes around the world. And I think this is what I would just add. I think all of the dimensions you mentioned of why these myths are so persistent are absolutely true. Something that I would add from my research that I've been involved in is that, of course, especially in the last 10 to 15 years, there has been a growing, I would say, right-wing populist or even right-wing extremist front that very deliberately worked on characterizing migration as the absolute future downfall of Europe, whereas we both just try to make the argument for this is Europe's future, right? But also inventing, really, and a kind of tabula rasa inventing ideas like the Great Replacement Theory, which is not a scientific theory, but I think which we now know, looking at also mainstream discourse, has been so successful, you know, in entering all these mainstream debates and in really characterizing migrants, both regular and irregular, I feel, as the main threat to European identity, European economies, European prosperity, and so on, that even this implicitly, of course, this theory or these ideas found their way into the newest US, military and security strategy, right? Because this is exactly what is in there. I think it is in a sort of more, perhaps in a more comfortable manner or in a more sort of sanitized manner, it is these basic ideas of what this Great Replacement Theory says. And this is an extremist theory that has no basis in reality, but it was really invented to also shake up European countries and produce increasing instability and increase the votes for the right-wing populists or even the right-wing extremists. And I think they have been very successful in doing that, also because the mainstream parties haven't really been able to counter that. To the contrary, they very happily jumped on the bandwagon in many cases.
Exactly. Oh, there's so many thoughts, you know. So to get back to, you know, you mentioning irregular or undocumented migration, there are studies in macroeconomics that also show that it's very similar, the patterns are very similar to regular and legalized economic migration. And I think if you look at the economic cycles, it's 6 months to about a year lag of, you know, economic boom attracts more people, economic recession decreases migration, and the irregular migration or undocumented migration follows the same patterns. So I think De Haasman said something, and you know, it's all about economics, stupid, in his book. That's his quote. Absolutely right that it's the discourses and the narratives that shape this paradox. And I think, you know, that maybe the biggest confusion in these discourses is that on one hand, you know, the politics would say migrants are taking our jobs, which is not true. They're filling the jobs that locals do not want to do or are not able to do, or simply not enough locals are there. But at the same time, in the same political campaigns, you will see them saying migrants live on our welfare. So, you know, you can't do both things at the same time, steal somebody's job and live on their welfare. Literally, there's a paradox in the slogan. And yet that's what you see through and through. And I think that's simply a great topic of distraction from the realities of, you know, the country's welfare state, economic state, housing situation that should be tackled internally. But usually it's much easier to project something on the external, you know, again, them or others. And so that's why it's been so successful, because it's just a much easier tool, not facts, a reality-based tool.
Hmm. What do you think we as scholars or academia at large can do to counter these myths or even to bust them once and for all? What's our role in this? And perhaps also what's the role of the media? Because we also need the media to communicate, mm-hmm. right? I mean, as great as this podcast is, it has kind of a restricted audience.
I hope it will grow. It's just the beginning. I'm
definitely
sure it will grow immensely.
So we need the media, obviously, but also policymakers, politicians use and need the media, and that's sort of another realm, right? So where's our responsibility? Where is our field of influence? And where do we also have to rely on other social actors?
Oh, that's a really nice question. You know, it depends, I think, also on a discipline. So sociologists like yourself, anthropologists, political science, for a big part also labor economists, labor lawyers, they have written about the realities of migration for a long time. Business and management scholars have entered this debate about a decade ago, perhaps. And a lot of times there's still misunderstandings even in our own writing, I think, because, you know, we don't have time to read the literature that's out there already, interdisciplinary literature. So the step one for business and management scholars is to familiarize themselves with existing work, to not reinvent the wheel, but to provide the new element, the business element, right, as an important player. So start with one's own research. I think that's the beginning. And then I'm a big believer in the, what here is called the third mission, right, which is a very big factor at VU. So translating research for the broader public, I do think it is our job, right? I don't think we should sit in the ivory tower producing things just for ourselves, especially because social science is science that engages with the society, because business and management is relatively applied science, right? So for me, we have to engage. That's partially what we do at the Competence Center STAR, and what we're trying to do with AIDA. It's a whole other initiative, migration business and society that we run. It's registered as an NGO, but it tries to bring together scholars that work on migration in the business and management area from around the world. We have around, you're one of our members. We have around 200 members, right? And the way we do this is we have a very strong advisory board that consists of seasoned scholars. So professors from Oxford, Harvard, CBS, Pepperdine. We have practitioners. That's extremely important to engage actual business leaders, chief human rights officers, right? Or former chief human rights officers and chief human resource officers, both, right? And then seasoned also policymakers. So we have Dilip Ratha from the World Bank, and they inform our work as a scholars in our meetings and roundtable discussions. Then we take that work to our members, that is 200 community of scholars. And then on one hand, we encourage them to do relevant research, translatable research. And on the other hand, we ourselves provide policy briefs, guides, reports, tools. I mean, we've also written together, right, the guidance for employees during the so-called refugee crisis a few years ago. So for me, these translation methods are really the key start. And I know you are really good at engaging with media here in Austria. And I think that's also the key, right, to get out of a building, get out of a campus and talk and let the research be visible. That's and not to mention teaching, but we can make it into a different question, right? That's my biggest probably passion here is to change things through teaching as well.
Definitely. I'm wondering how important actual storytelling here is, because we now talked very much on the basis of facts and statistics, and did the main myth that we started with, you know, there's only a small percentage of the world's population that can be considered migrants, and you have a hard number there. And there is a lot of empirical evidence to support this claim. I also know, and this is what my last book was about, when I talked to one of my right-wing friends, you know, so friends who would sort of lean to the right-wing or at least conservative spectrum, they would listen to this. They would maybe say, interesting. Still, I really feel it's too much. You know, that would be the reply. And anything that they feel that is their immediate perception of the world is so much stronger and so much more relevant to them than any kind of statistical number or figure I could present to them. And so in how far, and that's, of course, a fine line, I think, in how far do we as academics, as scholars, who are working, of course, with empirical evidence or even producing empirical evidence, have to also engage in storytelling and framing the debates and presenting narratives, in even trying to not only capitalize on the rational argument, but also the emotional one, you know, to get actually people to listen and to maybe open up a bit more, because I feel like statistics as such, you know, it's interesting to have them and it's great for a PowerPoint slide, but not necessarily to change people's hearts and minds.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, my MBA course here that I teach every October is business ethics and CSR. And we start that course on the first day just talking about the fact that all these big topics, you know, very kind of hot topics, climate change, migration, those are probably the two biggest ones, but also biodiversity loss, pollution, etc. Statistics and science is one thing, numbers are one thing. But at the end of it all, it's all about the moral agreement, you know, among a group of people, whether policymakers or broader society. It's about how we define our dictionaries, and so to say, metaphorically, right? It's about how we talk about these numbers. We use in the class always the example of this is climate change, but you can adopt it to migration too. If we measure the CO2 emissions per capita, or per general GDP per country, right? That they're very different numbers. You know, if you're looking at the overall CO2 emissions per country, China is always number one. If you look at per head, per person, it's a very different picture. So now statistics are the same, basically, right? But it's our narrative. Which story do we choose is what matters. And I think that's where social science cannot detach itself from the narrative. In the first place, social science is not about just hard numbers. So we need to choose the how we tell the story. I'm with you there that I think it's our responsibility as scholars.
And something that I also found so strong in the keynote that you gave during this myth-busting migration event that we had, is that you were not afraid of also positioning yourself in the debate, which is something that I also feel very often is necessary, right? And you also brought to the forefront that you are speaking not only as a scholar or as an academic, you are speaking as a migrant in this country. Many people looking at you, you are blonde, blue eyes, white. It's important to mention white, you know, because we know how the discourse works, would not, first of all, see you as a migrant. And if they realize your German has a slight accent, then they might say you're an expat. Because also you have a highly educated background, you work at a university, you are in a community of other expats from the global north. And so, yes, okay, but certainly some of these myths or discourses, assumptions, prejudices do not really apply to you, right? So, yes, all the foreigners, but not you, okay? We don't mean you. Which is, I think, an especially strong discourse here in Austria, because the biggest group of migrants are Germans, right? And so whenever someone says something about the migrants, I like to point to this fact and I say, well, of course, not the Germans. And I say, well, statistically speaking, they are sort of the main group that should concern us, right? Yeah. So it's interesting. And do you feel like, because I also had the experience that putting yourself out there, not only as a scholar and presenting facts and figures, but as a whole rounded person who also has experienced either migration, discrimination, who is in my case a citizen of this country and who experiences this strong tendency of especially this country to vote for populists and what this does to social cohesion, to integration and other things. This has pros and cons, clearly. What is your take on this? And what is your experience with also using your own, your full persona and not just your professional identity to engage with this really tricky debate?
No, that's the first time anybody asks me this question. And I'm very glad this is disclosure for those who are listening that we didn't prepare, you know, I didn't prepare in advance. So I'm thinking on the spot as you're asking this. And as I said, my background, my PhD was actually in humanities, you know, in comparative literature. My PhD was, dissertation was on exile writers. So definitely the topic of migration, but from a very different discipline. And kind of the guiding voice there was Edward Said, a famous, you know, Palestinian writer, author, thinker, exile in the United States. And he said, you know, as scholars, we have to kind of be aware of our subjectivity, no matter what. Let's not pretend that social science can be completely detached from our own identities. We usually pursue the topics we're interested in. Obviously, that's the case of myself. I emigrated at the age of 17, being more than half of my lifetime away from my home country, my passport country. So for me, though, and in addition, being a migrant, adds this another layer of subjectivity and ability to look at least two or more cultures kind of from the sidelines, right? And I think that's a wonderful advantage if you're aware of that, that you're kind of not fully attached anywhere anymore after a certain point. There's really no such place as home. And that informs a lot of your work, right? So for me, there's no way to actually hide it. This is who I am. This is my identity. And that flows into my work, does not make my work any less scientific. It just helps me to, inform my interests and kind of in the way I talk about the actual research, right? So for me, it's an illusion to think that a social scientist can completely detach themselves from where they come from. And I have a funny story for you, here in Austria, since you mentioned. So I said I left my home country at the age of 17. I've gone through all kinds of stages of being an unwanted migrant. I did some undocumented jobs to pay my way through education in the US. I don't think anybody will catch me now. But, as a student, I cleaned rabbit cages, cleaned houses, did all kinds of things to just survive. And I know that at that time, the Eastern European fame, especially in countries like Great Britain or Norway, led to Brexit, so it was not great. So I was kind of very cautious whenever I traveled back to Europe, if I traveled through Britain, to not disclose my identity, to make sure my accent sounded more American, less Eastern European. I wasn't always embracing, my status at migration that much as a migrant. But here in Austria, you're right. I noticed that I am privileged. I arrived here right away as a university assistant. So a great job. By the way, paying into the Austrian tax system from day one. Austria has never invested a euro in my education or health or anything, until I was an adult. And my first year, I had this incident where I was looking for an apartment, and one of your major newspapers had an ad that said, we're renting, private renting, but no migrants, please. Oh, wow. I was shocked that could say that. And this was really one of the standard newspapers that mainstream newspapers.
What year was that?
This was 2016.
Wow. 2016. Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, I called.
Migrant.
This had to be an experiment. My German was good enough already. So on the phone, they couldn't tell, I guess. They gave me an appointment. I went to see the apartment. It was actually a very lovely older couple. They offered it to me right away. And I asked them, how about your ad, right? And then they said, we meant not you, those other migrants, right? And I did not take the apartment. My personal conscience wouldn't allow me to. But that became to me very clear how things work here, within my first 6 months, that there are migrants and there are those other migrants.
The Austrians. Yeah. Oh, yes, that sounds very Austrian to me. Yeah. I'm allowed to say that.
After 10 years in the US, I was shocked that, about political incorrectness being so blatant in the actual ad. To add here to how these myths and stories get propagated, this was a very nice elderly couple, yes, who were really worried about, the potential criminality of their tenants, right? Or some kind of wrong background, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the reason why I went there was first an ethnographic study for myself, autoethnographic, but was also to understand their perspective, And I think, I hope that at least, because I asked them and I told them I am a migrant, that maybe it was a tiny little effect of kind of mixing up their image. Because, that's also another statistics that I love to tell. Actually, migrants are very, very unlikely to commit crimes, especially heavy crimes, statistically, right? Especially first-generation migrants are among the lowest criminal rates because they don't want to be deported. But, this fear, public fear is always there. Mm. So for me, this little personal story really, engraved in my head, I must work on this topic while I'm here.
Oh, yes.
Well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Must continue this.
Yeah. It really shows you how impactful this whole media and political discourse has been, right? Because in their mind, and I think this is probably very much informed by the overall debate, is that a migrant is, basically a rapist, someone who might murder you in your sleep, someone who's dangerous, who's here irregularly, who has no right to be here, definitely a man. Another young woman,
exactly.
And all this.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard, especially if just telling by the demographic structure, like an elderly couple, they might be more socially isolated by now. I don't know. If you don't have any possibility or option to verify or falsify these claims, how would you know, right? If you never meet migrants in your daily life and only mostly read or hear about them from the media, then of course, these assumptions, I think, can easily form, especially in a country like Austria, where I do think not by chance we've had a very strong right-wing populist vote of at least 20 to 30% in the last 20 or 30 years. It's growing, very much growing. And that explains, I think, some of this discriminatory attitude, but it also explains some of these paradoxes, really, because the Austrians do live in a, I'm sorry to say, changing country, a country that has already changed massively. When we look at the population structure right after the Second World War, where with authoritarian means, yes, the population was homogenized. So in the sense that there was less diversity than before the war, because, you know, we exiled a lot of people and killed a lot of people. So what was left was a more homogeneous population. But since 1945, we've seen growing and increasing diversity ethnically, religiously, linguistically, and so over the last decades. And we now live in a country that is very much an immigration country. But when you listen to politicians or look at the news or also look at these attitudes that some people might present, you might feel that this is not the case, you know? Yeah. And then again, something that adds to the paradox is I've made the experience that, and this is something I would sort of present here as an hypothesis, even if you were not this white young lady, very nice, you know, highly educated, even if you were more of a, like a stereotypical migrant, let's say someone with a different skin tone, someone who's not that highly educated, I think there would actually be a chance, you know, if when this elderly couple meets you, that they'd be open to the experience because they have an actual person in front of them. And then perhaps it is a refugee family and they realize, yes, they are refugees. Yes, they are forced migrants. They are here in an asylum, a residence title. But, you know, they actually have the same human concerns, interests, worries, fears, desires, aspirations for the future, like all of us. But here is my reality check. And it's not the masses of people, but it's actual individuals. And I think this is such an important, really, really valuable experience to make. So yes, for you, I think what you did, it wasn't just a social experiment. It was also confronting people with some of their prejudices and falsifying them, actually.
You're making a really, really good point. You know, so my research is very broad and very global. I'm definitely more of a globalist and I don't have insights into the depths of, let's say, policies here or political swings here in Austria. But I think what you say apply anywhere. I mean, Brexit was mostly, you know, pro-Brexit votes mostly came from people who had very little contact with migration. It's very clear with the urban areas like London, where migration, you know, is what, more than 50% of the city, the diverse population, right, versus the rural areas. We know that very well, that people who vote against migration and who fall to these for these narratives are usually people who are not exposed to it. And the moment you have, you know, that kid in your kid's classroom, right, and it becomes human, or you work with somebody from a different background and it becomes human, we know the same applies to businesses. Businesses who hire, for example, forced migrants, it was shown both in Sweden and Australia, some of the first empirical research comes from those countries, they're more likely to hire refugees, again, because they know that these are people with a great talent a lot of times, very resilient, very innovative, and willing and, you know, loyal, because they really appreciate the chance to work. So if you have the contact with a migrant, chances are you will become more, you know, realistic about migration. And if you're a business person, you'll hire migrants again. Problem is, a lot of times this fear is generated among people who don't have much contact, right? Or see only the negative, because once you look for negative, of course, you can always find it. Migrants are also just humans. So I'm also not pro open borders, right? I'm also very realistic about the generally.
Not in times like these, I'm afraid.
Absolutely.
Where we keep invading
other countries. No, and, you know, yes. And I mean, humans are humans. Yes. Every population has, you know, take any population, it will have the same issues, problems, individuals, personalities, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not about your status of, you know, mobility. It's about you being a human.
I think we have to be also as scholars really realistic on the one hand. I mean, there is a great academic argument for open borders. We know that when it's an economic argument, yeah, mainly. Exactly. We're not getting into that. I might do another episode on that.
You should
I
get
think I should actually, yes. but there is an argument here that can be very, that is very well thought through. On the other hand, I think when it comes to, you know, communicating to the public and also to policymakers, I think we have to be realistic to a certain point. And we live in a world that is structured and organized by nation states, whether you like it or not, but that is a central organizing principle in the world we live in. And as I just said, somewhat laughingly, but really, I think it's a very serious matter. Borders matter in the sense that national sovereignty matters. So if you have another foreign nation crossing the border into a nation and trying to invade the country, to take parts of the country, to take possession of regions or even individuals, you know, this, I think, in this day and age we live in, has some serious consequences. And this only works, you know, to keep also international law standards and principles if we also keep this organizing principles of the nation state of borders. But borders don't need to be sites of death and human suffering and of, you know, excluding people and people, you know, letting people die, basically, which we see around the world. And at the same time, it is sometimes really tricky to communicate all of this that we've now just, you know, discussed in this episode to politicians, to the public, to policymakers. Based on what you just said, also this, I would say, contact theory, which is what it basically is, right? You know, if you have direct contact to individuals, you realize they are humans too. And there is nothing to be afraid of. And it doesn't even mean that you suddenly become friends with everyone. That's not how it works. But you just realize that there is something very specific and tangible here that a picture of mass movement just doesn't hold for you. Yeah. How can this be translated in actual policies? Or how can this fact that I just mentioned, you know, we can have borders that are still being kept as borders, but that do not have to be sites of death and suffering? How can we translate this into actual policies? Mm-hmm. Or at least communicate to policymakers, this is what you should focus on, and your policy at the end of the line should contain A, B, and C, because this is where we provide empirical evidence for it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have natural experiments that have worked well to a certain extent. The European Union, right? It was about erasing the borders. And of course, yes, we have Brexit and we have backlashes and we don't know if it will last through our lifetimes, the structure. But it was a perfect natural experiment of a fear of mass influx from the new EU countries in 2004, 2010, which did not materialize, or that is materialized very temporarily, just for the few years, you know, when, and that's kind of also shown in other natural experiments of decolonializing countries, right? Like some of the territories of France or Denmark abroad, that once you open the borders, right, at first there's a bit of this influx because just excitement almost, right, for opportunities.
Hooray,
abroad.
Yeah.
But very soon, as I said, with Eastern Europe, it equaled out. It's insane that the change, you know, being from immigrant sending to immigrant receiving countries happened in less than 10 years, basically, time. So European Union shows how it actually can work in reality. And then I think for current policymakers, again, paying attention to the actual economies and to the businesses' needs. Much of the trouble that we have today is from this policymakers not acknowledging the realities of demands for jobs at different levels, both high-skill talented jobs and jobs that require perhaps less skills or more manual skills or relevant skills. I don't like the term low skill because most skills are relevant, right? Or sector-specific. So if policymakers acknowledge the realities that a lot of business people know, then they should tackle the corruption in how people whom we need, you know, get to arrive to take the jobs, get to arrive to the places that have jobs. Because this is one of my research interests is, you know, corruption and migration. It's huge. I was just talking now before Christmas with Aurette van Herdin. He's a former head of Fair Labor Association and now has a consultancy called Equiception. And he was telling me about these corruption circles that, you know, import third country nationals to EU through completely illegal means, or, you know, declaring that they need 2,000 workers when they only need 5, and then getting these people in and then kind of letting them loose cross borders within the EU. It's always the matter of the structures and of money-making machines that, you know, smugglers and traffickers or other semi-legal organizations have to bring people in for the jobs that are, you know, very much needed to be filled here, but in very corrupt, illegal ways, and that leave people in debt, that leave people unable to move back and forth, because most people, if they can, they will circulate back to their home country, let's say after the season is over. So for me, the main policy really is to tackle these networks, right, of corruption that allow human rights violations of migrants. And, you know, migrants' rights are human rights. So this is really, so one policy focus is just generally policy on you know, economics, and the other one is on corruption in these on these topics.
Mm-hmm. And I think your argument really nicely shows how the focus needs to be actually on more regular migration, on enabling regular migration, opening pathways, regular safe roads to also for humanitarian migrants, but especially also for people answering to the labor demand in mainly the global north, right? And if we don't have that, then all these illegal practices, on the one hand, smugglers, corruption, etc., human trafficking, huge, huge issue. And again, the most vulnerable women and children are most exposed, of course, to these practices. But if we don't focus on that, and if we become more and more restrictive, these are the ones that benefit, you know, these dark forces, let's say, the criminals, actually. And of course, migrants or people on the move, people looking for simply a better life and perspectives, will respond to what is available. And if there are no legal open pathways to labor, but also to safety, then, of course, they will choose the irregular ones.
And, you know, statistically speaking, most pathways that are legal, and most pathways are legal, let's go back to the big myth, right? Most seasonal or temporary migration pathways are legal, but they require the future workers to pay enormous recruitment fees. And, you know, I always say this in my courses, and my students, you know, are, whoa, how can this be? If you take a Nepalese worker who's being hired here in Europe, most European countries, including also UK, require, you know, visa processing fees, passport processing fees, et cetera, medical test fees, and those all fall on the worker back in their country of origin. And then this is where these corrupt organizations step in and say, we will process those fees for you, but you, all those documentation, but you need to pay us, let's say, $7,000 or euros, right? And for a Nepalese worker, if you translate that into, you know, what would be equivalent of our salary, this may be like 150K euros for a Western European, you know, person. So I always tell my students, would you ever pay, you know, 2 years of your future salary or 3 years of your future salary just to get a job abroad? Because after those 2 or 3 years, you'll still be able to save. And maybe your visa is 4 to 5 years, right? And that's the moral, you know, the decision of the person. But it's really the system that needs to be tackled. There are many great initiatives under the umbrella of employer pays. And for me, that's also the absolute key. Businesses who need workers should pay for all those processing and recruitment fees. There's no question. You know, if you need to fill the job, you should pay for the people to enter and fit the job. And there are really dozens and dozens of NGOs and think tanks that work in that area. And I see great improvement there, great progress of these legal pathways now being also, you know, done in the right, financially correct and ethically correct way. So for me, this is one of the key. Again, it's not the smuggling because you're undocumented. It's literally you're paying because you think you're doing the right thing by paying these organizations that will take you abroad, right? So that can be tackled and must be tackled at a policy level, at the and businesses level. Some leading companies really have shown, you know, stepped in and voluntarily said, we will take and cover all these fees. And that's for me kind of a, especially multinational enterprises, they should take that responsibility. There's no question.
It should be part of actually corporate social responsibility when we talk about these issues, right?
I mean, think of the high-skilled people, right? If you get hired from one company to another, they'll pay for your trip, they'll pay for your visa, right?
Nobody for your family's trip, actually.
For your families, you would not expect. I mean, this is absolutely insane. And yet this is one of the key issues today that eventually leads to forced labor because people end up being in debt. And
it's modern slavery.
Yeah.
It's modern slavery.
They can't leave their job places, etc. So this is... No, my biggest heartache that situation still continues. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's not end on a heartache, but let's end on a hopeful note. What makes you optimistic? Which is a really tough question to answer at the beginning of 2026. What gives you hope? What makes you optimistic? But I'm still asking it because I think we all need to hear some ideas of what might lay ahead of us that could inspire hope in us or optimism or just like a more positive outlook on the future?
Well, in the way I was, you know, already mentioning, there are great initiatives that are already taking place. There are leading businesses. There are business alliances that are trying to do the right thing, right? I mean, of course, they're always balancing profits versus ethics, but there's at least open talk about this. And, you know, for most senior leaders in business companies, if you ask them, you know, would you like to have a nightmare because we'll find modern slavery in your supply chain? They will say no, right? So there's open conversation. There are really a number of organizations worldwide that are working on improving things, and that's positive. And I think those organizations just have to hold their nerve this year with all the political backlashes and just keep working at it. And for me, maybe the biggest hope usually is it's not looking into the future simply, it's looking into the past. Mm-hmm. You know, history, how do I put this? You know, history always moves too slow for one person's lifetime. We always want the change and we want it now. But if you look at our entire civilization, it's moving very fast. And the fact that we're here, two women sitting and discussing these topics, is not something my grandmother would have taken for granted. So, meaning historically, there have been enormous changes in the last 150 years or 200 years. You name it, take any topic, you know, of equality, inequality, and you'll find those good changes. But they come, you know, you need a lot of patience. They come with backlashes. But that's just the way that history works. So for me, that's my optimism comes from the fact that if we are patient and we just keep working, you know, the backlashes will fade away. And eventually somehow, you know, I hope we can't roll back the clock all the way to the Middle Ages anymore, for sure. Mm.
Be more persistent than the myths. Perhaps
exactly.
That's a good motto.
And, you know, realistic. So, yeah. Mm.
I think that is a very good and pragmatic, hopeful message. Be realistic. I like that. Thank you so much, Milda, for being my guest today. It was a great honor and pleasure talking to you. And thank you to all my listeners today. And I hope you will tune in for the next episode. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Wenn euch diese Folge gefallen hat, abonniert Aufnahmebereit auf Spotify oder allen anderen gängigen Podcast-Plattformen und folgt Judith Kohlenberger und der Chefredaktion auf ihren Social-Media-Kanälen. Fragen, Anregungen und Beschwerden an aufnahmebereit@wu.ac.at. Alle Infos findet ihr auch in den Shownotes. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Aufnahmebereit wird ermöglicht durch eine Förderung des Wissenschaftsvermittlungscalls vom Wissen der Vielen, der MA7, der Stadt Wien. Danke an die KooperationspartnerInnen von Die Chefredaktion und der Podcastwerkstatt.
Podcastwerkstatt.